Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
What Trump has kind of done is make sort of trading floor right wing a bit cool. You started seeing people doing the Trump dance. That is now the thing that's considered entertaining, funny. It's on the main stage. The stories that the country's paying attention to are shifting to sort of, you know, Taylor Swift and her football player boyfriend. I mean, I think the whole, like, woe is me whimpering from a 7/8 Caucasian, you know, quote unquote, black noblewoman, like, people are done with it.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Wilfred Riley. Will, welcome to the show.
Great to be back on.
Great to have you back on. And there's a lot to talk about in relation to your great nation of the United States of America, which the whole world is watching right now. And I was thinking before this podcast, I was thinking the last time we had you on was to talk about your excellent book, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me, which I can see behind you on your shelf, which is a great book, picks apart so many modern myths of, I guess, what we might call progressive ideology or progressive thinking or liberal thinking. And one of the things that it picks apart is something that you've been picking apart for quite some time, is the claims of the kind of identitarian politics, the idea that America is just a nation born from racism, it will never recover from racism unless it has, you know, affirmative action, identitarian initiatives, DEI, etc., etc. You've been challenging some of that thinking for some time, and America is now ruled by a president who seems to share some of your views and who is dismantling DEI before the eyes of the world, and things do seem to be changing quite dramatically. So what's your take on how things are going, especially in relation to the dismantling of the DEI regime? Do you see this as a positive thing?
Yeah, I mean, so my first reaction to Trump overall was that I was surprised by the competence on display. Like, I've always gotten a kick out of Trump. I mean, I have some business background myself. I mean, he's the sort of archetypal big New York guy who does a lot of dramatic things and, you know, says a lot of things of, you know, varying levels of quality. The first presidency was interesting. I mean, I don't think that during his first presidency as a political scientist, Trump actually accomplished everything that he said he was going to do. I mean, his focus was, I'm going to build the wall. And in fact, I think he put together a total of maybe 700 miles of fencing on the border. So a lot of that didn't necessarily get accomplished, but I've always gotten a kick out of him. But when he came back into office, I mean, he was ready to go. And I mean, I think that during his time out of power, there's been the Project 2025 has been overhyped a little bit in the state's media. But there's definitely been some consolidation of very intelligent people in the Claremont Institute, for example, Heritage, Manhattan Institute, AEI. They've come up with some ideas and put some of those together in books that I think he's read. Like Dick Hanania's commentary on the roots of wokeness and civil rights law, or Jeremy Carl's The Unprotected Class about discrimination against whites and men. And I mean, when Trump came back into office, he had about 192 executive orders, and they were really, really specific. I mean, one of them was called Prioritizing People Over Fish, and it dealt with water distribution in the U.S. West Coast watershed. But I mean, more seriously, like, one of them was a direct repeal of Executive Order, I believe it's 11546, which was what established affirmative action in U.S. federal government hiring and contracting. So, I mean, I was pretty surprised that Trump was just on deck to that point. And that's the main thing that was notable about him to me.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, that there is a bit more in relation to the second Trump administration. There does seem to be a lot more coherence. I mean, political coherence, organizational coherence, I guess ideological coherence. It does seem to be a bit more steady and a bit more stable. Do you put that down to the influences around Trump? Or as you've just said, that he's clearly been reading or has been speaking to some of these people who've got these ideas. Do you think he himself has changed? How do you explain that kind of the more smooth feeling to it this time around?
I think to some extent he just knows what he's doing. I've had friends that have gone from the private sector into the government in D.C., and one of them famously described it as being like an air-breathing mammal thrown into water. I mean, it's a very different, much more regulated, I imagine London or Paris would be the same kind of thing, environment. The bureaucracy is absolutely amazing. I mean, and, you know, Trump himself has mentioned being aware of this at the state level, just when it comes to a major building project, where you first have to go through sort of a native lands assessment. Are you disturbing the artifacts of these ancient peoples? And this is in Manhattan, New York City, right? I mean, then you go through environmental assessments, and then you go through a process of permitting, and you probably pay some bribes, honestly, and all this, and then you finally get the building done. I mean, he's described DC as being 10x worse than that. So I think that one of his big questions the first time was, how do I get competent people that are familiar with this system, but that do want to change some aspects of it with me? And that was a constant issue that he had, where he would take people that I think in a conventional Republican administration would have been very good, like the general Mad Dog Mattis. But there were constant clashes with Trump because Trump wanted to do some things differently. And I mean, I think Mad Dog ended up resigning. Other people were fired. I mean, he had John Bolton rotating into the White House at one point, you know, and didn't manage to declare war during his time there, unusually for him. But I mean, just that, I think Trump has managed to move past a little bit. So, yeah, I think he has some people around him. Stephen Miller comes to mind that he's grown to trust. I mean, his own inner circle, Ivanka, Jared Kushner, so on, are no joke when it comes to some of these issues. And again, I mean, I think he has engaged with Carl. He's engaged with Chris Rufo, a lot of people in that conservative intellectual space. So to some extent, he's more aware of what he has to do. And yeah, I think there are more people that are there willing to help him do it. And as a final comment, I think that explains a lot of his picks this time around. So, I mean, when you look at Pete Hegseth in defense, you kind of see the answer to that question of how can you get people that are pretty competent, but that are going to be on board with you dramatically shaking things up. So Hegseth, actually, before going on to Fox News with either a light bird or a full colonel, he's a decorated military guy. He's actually written two books that I've read professionally about war fighting. But he moved out of the military pipeline of promotions, which would have brought him up to the highest rank, and had some fun. I mean, he was on TV for a while. He got accused of drinking too much. I mean, he's writing a lighter fiction. I mean, so he's doing all this stuff. And Trump was able to say, hey, do you want to come back into this former career and work with me? So I think he's maybe picked up a little bit about who the people that are going to help him do what he wants to do might be. And I am looking forward to what he does, to seeing what that's going to look like.
Yeah, I remember reading this story about Pete Hegseth having a drink at work, and I thought to myself, where's the problem? I don't see the problem with having a beer at work every now and then. In relation to, so he's got these people around him. He's more engaged, I think, or it seems that he's more connected to his advisors and his team than he was last time. Last time it was all a bit chaotic and quite Shakespearean at times, skullduggery and so on. But outside of the Trump set as well, another striking thing I've seen, and others have noticed it too, is that there seems to be less Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, it's still out there. It's a malady that is uncurable, it seems, but it's much less pronounced than it was in 2016, 2017. It's, you know, we haven't seen woke people wailing on the streets. The media has been a bit calmer this time than it was last time. What do you think explains that? Do you think it's people have just woken up to the fact that Trump is not a blip, and there really are tens of millions of Americans who want him to push through the changes that he's pushing through. How do you explain the demise of Trump derangement syndrome?
Well, I think there are two things. One, we've already seen Trump as president. And even though there were, you know, ugly street fighting incidents like January 6th and so on, he obviously did not make himself dictator. You know, he didn't cross the Rubicon, take over DC, assume command of the military. I mean, the insane things that were being said on the fringes of the left. I mean, that's point one. But I think point two also is that we saw the Democrats for 4 years. So, I mean, the ordinary American, I don't know about extreme fringe wokes, but the ordinary American looked at the implementation of almost ideal center left to left Democratic policy on policing following the death of George Floyd and noticed that murders again skyrocketed over 20,000. And that doesn't seem coincidental. I mean, that's what happened in the 1960s. That's what happened, you know, prior to Giuliani's return to actual law enforcement in New York. We saw it happen again. I mean, and a lot of people realized, like, essentially, oh, not enforcing the law really does have these impacts, because there's been such a blizzard of chaff thrown out in American social science to distract from that for decades. I mean, people saw just mass immigration at a crazy level, where you'd go down to the Darien Gap with drones and you'd see these armies of people looking like Aztec refugees just walking toward the country. And I mean, it struck a lot of people. Well, this is something that you could stop at any time. You literally could just put up a high fence on the border and this wouldn't happen. So it became harder to say that Trump was not maybe a little too tough, not, you know, a little too much of the domineering uncle, but was in fact an evil figure, when the people that replaced Trump were doing things that objectively seemed to be at least as troubling or at least as corrupt. I mean, anyone with access to WikiLeaks can see the full Hunter Biden scandal, the number of girls on his computer, many of whom don't look very old. I mean, the cocaine, there's a scene where he weighs an ounce of cocaine. I mean, it's just, that was what replaced Trump. So the whole idea of we'll get the adults in the room, I mean, I think a lot of people looked at Joe and Hunter, Kamala, and didn't really see where they were.
Yeah, it's the immigration question is so interesting, because one of the things Trump moved to do quite quickly was to deport criminals who were in America who shouldn't have been there. And there was that remarkable footage of a Haitian guy being deported. And he was saying, you know, long live Joe Biden and I love Obama. I can't believe Trump is doing this to me. It was such an extraordinary image that really summed up the past few years, I thought. In relation to this issue that you've written about for some time, which is the, I guess, the race question or the affirmative action question, the DEI issue more broadly, say a little bit about how radical you think Trump is being and what you think he's really trying to achieve with his dismantling of all this stuff. Because, you know, the polarized media, as an observer in the UK of all this, watching America, you can read one piece which says that Trump is being consistent with the vision of Martin Luther King. And then you can read another piece saying Trump is carrying on with his fascistic antics and black people are now finished in America. They're in big trouble. You can read such different interpretations of what Trump is trying to achieve. What's your reading of what he's doing?
Well, my reading of what he's doing is that this is only shocking in the context of what we've gotten used to in the relatively recent past in the USA. I mean, so in terms of American law, non-discrimination is actually written into our Constitution now and into the U.S. Civil Rights Act. So the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, passed after the Civil War, prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, previous condition of servitude. As I recall, sex is in there. The Civil Rights Act of 64 obviously prohibits discrimination based on race, ethnicity, nationality, sex, etc. And there have been some extensions of this by case law into sexual orientation. For example, we don't have class protection. But so there's a substantial body of law that says you can't discriminate against people in the normal sense. I mean, so you can't have a job posted at the executive level and hire only whites or only blacks or something like that. DEI is sort of a weird set of barnacles that was grifted onto that over the years, where the realization became that if you just hire in a totally neutral fashion, you actually don't get proportional representation. So this entire set of corporate programs was developed to, and a lot of this is just a smokescreen for hiring 10% black guys now, but this entire set of corporate trainings and diversity and the surrounding ideology began to be adopted over the years. In fact, in some districts now in the USA, it's a prima facie case for discrimination that the different races aren't proportionally represented in your business. So there's actually a conflict between civil rights law, which is just very simple. And I think I, Vada Rufa, most people would favor keeping the Civil Rights Act. You can't discriminate against whites. You can't discriminate against blacks or people of color, whatever term you want to use. And now, I mean, you have both those groups heavily represented in business. So that's good. But then you have all this other stuff over here, which says we expect absolutely equal representation of everyone. And if we don't see that, we have these complex theories about why. You know, institutional, systemic, low-level discrimination, so on. We have these programs designed to remedy that. Trump is getting rid of almost entirely the second thing. And I don't really object to that. I don't think most people object to that. The question is what the outcome of that will look like. I don't think it's going to entirely please anyone, actually. I took a look at MIT after all affirmative action was gotten rid of. And their incoming freshman class was about 5% black. And I mean, you can make some jokes there. I mean, how many of those people are from, you know, West African noble families and some of them are 5% black, 7% Latino, 30% Asian, East and South Asian. Among the whites, about, so this would be about 10% Jewish, I guess 20% of the white group, Mina would be the term we use. So you actually didn't see all blondes. You saw this extremely diverse picture. It was just different from the mandatory 20% Hispanics when you look at diversity. So, I mean, I think that's probably what you're going to get in at least higher end firms and that kind of thing. But it remains to be seen. We've had affirmative action in place since 1967. It's amazing how often that's forgotten in light of all of the constant talk about the oppression of minorities and so on. A Philadelphia plan was 67 under Mr. Nixon. So since that time, and that began in the construction industry, transferred very rapidly to white collar business. Since that time, if you were applying for a job as a black guy with a tie on, you probably have had an advantage over an equally qualified white competitor. And that's just been sort of not mentioned. It's been considered sort of tacky to bring it up because overall the black group or the Latin group was underperforming the white group. And it became a convention to say, well, the reason for that is racism. Now with some of these programs gone, I mean, I don't think people will be able to say that anymore. Or actually, I don't know. People will be able to say it more. We'll see.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
In relation to the DEI regime, and some people are referring to what Trump is doing as a form of regime change. You know, it's a peaceful, bloodless coup where he is not only kicking out certain ideas, but really dismantling a whole belief system that held pretty strongly in the United States over the past few years, and also in Europe as well. I think people forget how crazy DEI was sometimes. As you said, it related to hiring practices, it impacted on university campuses and intake of students and the affirmative question and so on. And that was incredibly important and sometimes very destructive. But also it gave rise, even in private companies, to this kind of system of almost re-education. You know, workers were often told, you know, don't be so white or check your privilege. And they'd wheel in Robin DiAngelo or Ibram X. Kendi or hand out their books to the poor workforce who, as if they weren't suffering enough, and make them read all this stuff and imbibe all this stuff. I mean, it really did become quite a widespread phenomenon, didn't it? And it played a role almost of re-educating a whole nation to think like the coastal elites, to take on those ideas. Do you think that's all going to fall down now as a consequence of what Trump's doing? Or was it too entrenched? Will it take a bit more effort to get rid of that stuff?
Well, yeah, I think that's a really good question. So I think there are two levels there. First of all, yes, there definitely is a DEI ideology. I think it's the ideology that the great Thomas Sowell responds to in Discrimination and Disparities. But essentially, the DEI framework is the idea that proportional representation is kind of the human default. That there are, and this gets into blank slateism at some level, right? Like there are very few differences between the great human races. In fact, there are probably none between the great human races. There are very few differences between men and women, gays and straights. People fall into the different social classes due purely to luck. I mean, a lot of this is just nonsense, but this is the idea. And so if you have a non-discriminatory, properly run business or social environment, everyone will be represented in exactly the proportions in which their group exists in society, in the social world. And it turns out that that's almost never the case. For example, I mean, I used to enjoy playing pickup basketball. I noticed that the National Basketball Association is all very large, people of African and Russian descent. I mean, it just is what it is. But this is something that's become very prevalent as an organizing frame. So the idea is basically all disparities, if you don't see proportional representation, are due to subtle discrimination somewhere. Ibram Kendi says this openly on page 2, I think, of How to Be an Anti-Racist, page 2 and page 12. But so if you see these gaps, the only two options are either genetic inferiority, although he doesn't phrase it that crudely, on the part of one of the groups, or some kind of subtle hidden racism we have to winkle out. And so this whole culture has developed around winkling out the subtle hidden racism. And that's what microaggressions are, stereotype threat is. What is the thing, this weird hidden thing that's making Black people score 10% lower on the test? And the reality is that what's making Black people score 10% lower on the test is probably studying 40% less. I mean, There is nothing defined there, but this has become very, very prevalent. The second part of your question is, are people going to cling to this even as people like Trump's team are saying, well, actually, there are a lot of explanations for these gaps. Asians are outperforming whites. I think to some extent, I think in HR, you'll see it among a cadre of upper middle class white women, you'll see it. But most people, I don't think, ever believed this. That's one of the things that I think is kind of interesting about some of my data results. And I actually wish I'd done some of this with professional polling as opposed to, you know, the 10,000 people on Twitter, Survey Monkey links, this kind of stuff for, you know, public intellectual articles. But I mean, the example that I usually use, which keeps coming to my mind, is that at one point I asked my entire social media following, do you believe some women have penises? I've mentioned this before, but I was curious. I thought that the way that the transgender questions were usually worded was intentionally misleading. Like, do you think trans female athletes should compete with their preferred gender as opposed to their preferred sex? And thinking about me looking at that as a working class kid of 19, I wouldn't have known what it meant. So, I mean, I favored the blunter, not to be crude, but like, do some women have dicks? And I decided to actually just ask that question. And I thought that the response would be like 70% no, you know, come on, Riley, but 30% yes from all the feminist girlfriends and so on that are on the page, that are across the social media where I was asking. And in fact, it was, if I recall correctly, 98% no and 2% yes. That could be off by a little. I don't want to misstate it, but it was just an overwhelming response from everyone, including the feminist business women that follow to engage in debate. Everyone said, no, I do not believe this. And I think that that's something that you'd see across a lot of the quote unquote woke beliefs. Is your upper middle class black buddy oppressed is another one that I've asked about, actually. And again, I think that was Facebook in a Survey Monkey link. These aren't the most professional, but it's the same sort of thing. And almost everyone says no. So the majority of people, I think, when you give them an opportunity just to say, well, no, this was all bullshit, what they're going to do is say, well, never believed it anyway. And it's just going to be like COVID-19. You know, I never locked down here in our city. We, you know, and people will move back to normalcy. What's needed is some strong figure to give you the chance to do that.
I really agree that it was not an ideology in its broadest sense that was subscribed to by most ordinary working class people. They didn't have time for this nonsense. And it was the kind of thing that was, it's the kind of ideology that is so insane, only students and billionaires could possibly believe it. And even billionaires no longer believe it. That's become clear over the past couple of weeks. I did, in fact, it follows on nicely from what you've just said. I did want to ask you about what you think the cultural impact of what Trump is doing might be. We know there's going to be a legal impact because he's dismantling all these ideas in federally funded institutions and government departments and so on. And no doubt there will be lots of legal challenges to some of his executive orders. There'll be a legal consequence. There'll be political consequences. You've said already we don't know what the long-term consequences will be, although it seems to be a positive move, generally speaking. But what about culturally? Because something that you and I have spoken about on this podcast before, and you've been talking about this for a long time, is the impact that this has at a cultural level. So one thing that you write a lot about over the years is the hoax hate crimes, for example, where the culture of victimhood is now so pronounced and so important in the cultural sphere that people will invent cases of violence against them in order to improve their social and political capital. And of course, we're all familiar with the articles in the press over the past few years. Dear white people, don't touch my hair. Don't wear my traditional dress. You know, don't appropriate my culture. It's been this ceaseless barrage of eccentric ideas that has just been thrown at us for so long. Do you think we'll see an end to that? Do you think that kind of, is it possible now for some, you know, well-off African-American 25-year-old woman to write a piece in the New York Times about how she's oppressed? Is that kind of stuff really going to connect anymore? Or is it game over for that?
I think that's done for a good long time. What I would say about it is that it's no longer cool. What Trump has kind of done is make sort of trading floor right wing a bit cool for the next, say, 10 years. I mean, with a lot of his, I won't say antics, but some of the things he said, but also genuinely admirable stuff like popping up after being shot at and waving his hand and saying, fight, fight, fight. I mean, and you know, after that happened, you started seeing people in some macho fields like the NFL or the mixed martial arts championships doing the Trump dance where they do the little wiggle that he used to do in nightclubs and he still does when he speaks. You know, I mean, and I think that is now the thing that's considered entertaining, funny. It's on the main stage. The stories that the country's paying attention to are shifting to sort of, you know, Taylor Swift and her football player boyfriend. I mean, you can follow trends in the media. So I think the whole, like, woe is me whimpering from a 7/8 Caucasian, you know, quote unquote, black noble woman, like, people are done with it for the moment. Yeah, I think that's good, essentially, and that'll continue for the usual period of a trend, 5 to 10 years. One of the things that I do think the right is going to have to check, or there's going to be a swing back pretty rapidly, is tolerance for totally immature racism, kind of on all sides, where you just go onto Twitter and it's like white guys posting openly racist stuff, but like Indian guys who might have an H-1B visa responding to them and saying that the Goralog should, you know, do whatever, and black guys chipping in. Elon Musk changed his name today, I think, on Twitter to Harry Balls or something like that. And I'm not saying this sardonically, yeah, you did. I think if you're trying to appeal to business women or people finishing up graduate school or something like that, like, a lot of this stuff, especially whether that's fair or not, the dissident right white guy stuff, there is going to have to be some cap placed on that. I mean, there now are social media pages with names like Blacks Taking L's. And I mean, obviously there are equally witty responses from minority men, but I don't think anyone likes those either. So the right is going to have to decide, is there some cap on, not acceptable, you can say whatever the hell you want in the Call of Duty, you know, entering salon, but is there some kind of cap on publicly acceptable or normative behavior? Because so much of this is just backlashing, and I understand it. I mean, I'm a man myself. I'm just now 40 myself. I mean, like, you get it. But so much of this is backlashing to HR department culture, where people for years were saying, oh, you can't dress like an Indian for Halloween. Now people are kind of saying, I'll do whatever the hell I want. And I think that's the thing that's currently being accepted as cool. You saw the front piece of NY Mag, New York Magazine, the Cruel Kids table, where they went to that ball. Like, people were literally throwing balls. CJ Pearson threw one. And they interviewed all these sorority girls, and people were walking around with purebred St. Bernards on the carpet and so on. I mean, that's going to be in vogue for a while. There are going to have to be some limits on it, or there's going to be a swing back left, I guess, would just be the summary.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And one thing I've been thinking about recently is the possibility of an overcorrection for political correctness. And it's almost like, you know, I think you're right that there is this sense that people have felt so suffocated over the past few years, and they've been in such a straitjacket of kind of correct think and correct speak that they now feel free at last. Trump has taken the straitjacket off, and people are kind of, you know, exercising their muscles and saying all the things you weren't allowed to say for so long, and they're kind of letting it all out. I've used this example before, but I read a piece recently about how the word retard has come back into fashion and is now commonly used in online circles I'm not particularly familiar with, I have to say, but there was this piece in a British newspaper about the return of the word retard. But there are, how far do you think that can go? And what do you think are the dangers of it? Because one thing that strikes me about Elon Musk, who's doing some interesting stuff, but Elon Musk and his kind of army of nerds in Doge, you know, Big Balls and those other people who he's got working for him, these young guys who are obviously a bit nerdish and kind of very willfully un-PC, and they relish in it, and it kind of can be a bit grating. But do you think that the backlash could come from the kind of MAGA working class? Because it does seem to me that there is a bit of a difference between the MAGA working class, which is a huge, huge block of American people, and this kind of Musk-led elite in the Doge department in particular, which seems to be quite eccentric and a bit nerdish. Do you think there's a tension there?
Yeah, well, I think to handle that first, yeah, there definitely is a tension between kind of boomers and zoomers who insult each other using those terms within the right. I mean, one of the things and now Britain, I think, understands this, England understands this better than most European countries, but in the USA, you only have two political parties. I mean, we don't have, you know, actual fascists and greens that dress like forest elves and all the other things that you see in continental Europe. I mean, so it's everyone is under these two massive labels. So just like the Democrats include everything from highly intelligent but mildly crazy feminists to, black radicals in the streets with signs to recent Muslim immigrants who hate feminists. I mean, it's just a giant tent, Jews. The Republicans include everything from evangelicals to me, to kind of, you know, cynical business types who are sitting around eating a steak, wondering what all this talk is about banning erotica. You know what I mean? Like, it's so they're huge, huge categories. And the boomers and zoomers are definitely two groups that are that come almost to fisticuffs all the time. But I think the thing, and I think, I guess the Republican Party just has to figure out how to regulate that. I mean, the Republican Party is the party of stable, fairly well-off people from working class backgrounds who are 60. I mean, the vote for the demographic I just described is probably 90% GOP, probably among whites. It's also the party for rising males who get out of good tech schools, or even for that matter, Big Ten or Ivy schools these days. By the time college is fully completed, grad school's begun. So you're just going to have to manage those tensions. But I think that when you get into the Zoomer group, you are the idea of an overcorrection, that kind of that neutral sort of Kathy Young media can really point out, that's going to start hurting the right. Yeah, that's very possible. There's a famous line from a scholar of Italian Renaissance art who said that traditionally human expression has thrived better under conditions of moderate repression than under conditions of full freedom. And I mean, I think that watching, like, I mean, what, Lily Phillips, the person who slept with 100 men and now is doing the US and UK television circuit and saying things like, oh, like cock. I mean, no offense, but like, just, yes, of course, some limit on that kind of thing. You know, it's probably going to improve her description of what she's doing and so on. It's the same thing with this, this backlash to HR department culture. For a period of years, people have been told that they're not supposed to say certain things, and not in any coherent, gentlemanly fashion, and sort of a nonsensical way that was made up by neurotics. So, you know, just black people. For at one point, I was told that I used an offensive word in one of my articles, and the word was blacks. And it became like a Monty Python style conversation. They said I used a offensive descriptor of black people, and I asked what it was, and they said blacks. And I said, well, you're saying I called blacks blacks. And they said, well, you called black people blacks. And this was part of the lead email exchange. It really went on. And that was the climate that we were living in. As we get out of that, yes, I think that there are a lot of people that are going to say, well, I can say anything now. Like the kid, I think this was Big Balls, one of those kids in the, but like, so the kid calls himself Big Balls, right? I mean, it's some online hacker that uses that as a name. But I mean, he was exposed as the guy who had all of these past tweets where he said things like normalize Indian hate. It was him or one of the other Doge young genii, but a normalize Indian hate. You couldn't pay me to marry outside of my race. A bunch of other things. And personally, I wouldn't care. It's more or less funny. Like, personally, I wouldn't care if you nuked Israel and Gaza. But the thing is, you're not, obviously, I don't agree with that sentiment, but you're not like sitting around a bar. You're actually saying this stuff online. I assume you have a good number of followers. The question is, do you want to normalize that? And I would say that as the right, at the level of people with non-anonymous accounts, no, you don't. The obvious reality is that people are going to backlash pretty strongly to that. You can say whatever you want. You often shouldn't. And we're going to go through a period of people expressing themselves by saying stupid shit right now. That's basically my opinion. But like, if you're a young executive listening to this, yeah, you probably shouldn't have your visible face on an online profile called Big Balls where you say this stuff. I mean, just like, yes, that is something that's going to affect the right.
Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. education. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
Hi, it's Fraser here, Deputy Editor of Spiked. I just wanted to let you know about a very exciting event that Spiked is hosting. On the 27th of February, Spiked will be celebrating our 25th birthday. And to mark the occasion, we'll be hosting a party in central London for all of the people who make our work possible. That's the Spiked team, various contributors, friends of Spiked, and crucially, our supporters. People like you who donate to us every month and allow us to keep doing what we do. If you're a Spiked supporter, a member of our online donor community, you can get your early bird tickets to our event now. But there are only very limited spaces available, so if you want to join us, please do not delay. To find out more, you can go to the supporters hub on our website by logging in or check your emails because you should have received an invite in your inbox. I hope to see you there. Now, on with the show.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
On that topic, yeah, I think, you know, it can be easy to forget just how stifling the culture of the past few years really was. I mean, there were the ridiculous things. Like, for example, there was a controversy over Meghan Markle and the British press's coverage of Meghan Markle. And one of the controversies focused on a newspaper's, a writer used the word niggling. She said she had a niggling bad feeling about Meghan Markle. And this was interpreted as a sly use of the N-word. And of course, it was no such thing. But those kind of pouncing on people for wrong thing and the way they spoke or the way they expressed themselves, I mean, that was the dominant theme of Western political life for a long time. So it's understandable that people feel relieved to be breaking out of that. But how do you think we do, if this does keep if we keep going down this road of people like Big Balls and others saying things that you previously were not allowed to say, how do you think we go about restoring a sense of decorum or a sense of sensible, measured, disagreeable, fiery debate rather than insults? Because I know a lot of people, I don't use X myself, but I know people who have left X over the past couple of years. And these are very sensible people, open-minded people. Some of them are free speech fanatics like me and like you. They've left X because they don't like to see Hitler being praised every day of the week. That's something they don't want to see when they turn on their computer, or they don't want to be told go back to Africa or whatever. I mean, and this is stuff they were seeing every single day. So obviously we don't want to go back to the old system of Twitter, which censored what it considered to be problematic speech. But is there something else that we can do in order to get discussion back onto an even keel? How do you think we might tackle that problem?
Well, I mean, I think at some level, people can just advocate for a normal standard where you block people that say things like go back to Africa, or for that matter, go back to Europe. I don't actually have a problem with there being a floor of behavior that you won't allow in your business. Like, I don't really see why a US or UK company should allow large scale praising of Hitler. I don't think you need to remove that person permanently, but you could certainly demonetize any message that was pro-Hitler, something like that. I mean, it would actually be quite easy to do. You could limit views on it. I mean, there are terms you can't. I mean, there are a lot of terms for, say, the female vagina that you generally can't post on social media. I don't see why you couldn't make Hitler one of those. So we're kind of playing games if we pretend that there's no way that a computerized sort of term scraper kind of program couldn't limit 95% of this. What's happening right now, and Elon Musk's Twitter does this, by the way, they limit the word cis. So you get demonetized if you refer to someone as cisgender. So, I mean, I personally, I would probably put Hitler in the same bucket of offensiveness as cisgender. I mean, and yeah, I guess that's, a lot of people have objected to the 4chanization of Twitter or of X. And I think that this is a real problem. Like in Chicago in grad school, I worked in the nightlife business and people had a saying, you can't let just everyone in the club. If you have 20 young men in a bachelor party show up already visibly drunk, looking to get into a fight, you're probably going to limit whether or not you let those guys into a nightlife venue because you're aware of what's going to happen. Unless you feel like brawling, that's not a good decision. And I think it's the same thing with this. Like, there's no particular reason you can't say, and I'm kind of repeating myself here, that there are checks placed on open advocacy for Nazism because this is a US platform. I mean, that's what I would do there, frankly. We're eventually going to have to work out a standard that doesn't limit touching Black women's hair consensually, but that does limit calling for the death of the Jews. And I don't think it's that hard to do that. I don't think it's that hard to stake out a position that's, you know, to the right of Che Guevara, but to the left of Hitler, and come up with some coherent speech norms and keep to those. That seems like it'd be quite easy, actually.
You've already mentioned the trans question and your survey asking people, do women have dicks? The only person who still can't answer that question, by the way, is our Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who has a nervous breakdown whenever anyone asks him that very question. One of the things Trump did, which I thought was extraordinary, but shouldn't be extraordinary, it should be perfectly normal and rational, was sign an executive order saying that men can't play in female sports. And we had that really staggering image of Trump doing that while surrounded by women and girls, you know, the sports stars of the future, who looked so happy and elated and were applauding him. And it was, in terms of political spectacle, it was really quite profound, I thought. And it and I know that there are even feminists here in Britain, old left kind of, you know, 1970 style feminists, and even they had to say, oh wow, well thank you President Trump for doing this. How do you think that is going to put a final nail in the coffin of the trans lunacy, the kind of more the excesses of the trans ideology? It's going to be difficult for people to wind back on that, isn't it? Because surely we're not going to have a situation where the Democrats will run on a ticket of letting men back into women's sports. Is that kind of done and dusted now?
Well, I think that, again, this is like the conservative ball and the people becoming aware that there is a coherent kind of upper middle class kind of right coded ethic, and that taking over the spotlight for a period of 10 years, probably with positive effects. I think that this is something that's going to go the same way. Most of mainstream society is going to backlash to the trans absurdity that was allowed for a while and sort of pretend on the part of like upper middle class female friends of mine, you can already see it, that it never happened. We never supported that. We just wanted to be kind, that kind of thing. I do think that there's going to be a hard core of resistance that people are going to have to be aware of, and that's probably going to bring this back to the fore again. Because if you look through the rise and fall of gender ideology, I mean, this has gone up and down for quite a while. I mean, Judith Butler was writing in the 70s and late 70s and 80s. And this was a feminist idea for a long time, that the feminists used to argue prior to modern GWAS genetic technology that almost all differences between men and women were socially conditioned, which is, of course, insane. But you can still pull up these articles saying that if you trained girls from an early age to be tough and aggressive, they'd be as tough and aggressive as men and so on. Now that they know that's obviously not true, they seem to have moved toward the idea that men are just evil, you know, like being more aggressive and inventive and violent is just bad, you know, and all this stuff. I don't really take this all that seriously. Like, I think in the absence of, you know, most ultimate morality, those three things are very, very useful. But anywho, with transgenderism, I think we're going to see another rise and fall. One of the reasons that this isn't going to just go away is that it can't. I mean, something like 100,000 kids have been physically affected by this, physically, in the United States. So, I mean, and I think that's fair to say. Like, when I talked at GenSpect about a year ago now, you know, there'd been 3,000 a year, maybe, for 5 years, and this is just under 18, double mastectomies performed on girls. The number of people that had been given pure testosterone for a period of at least a year, which is what was needed to record it for insurance purposes, was tens of thousands. I don't want to misstate the figure. But again, and that's under 18, over 18, I assume in college would be when most people are doing this. So you're going to have these tens of thousands, would be an extreme underestimate, hundreds of thousands to a million people that have done this stuff to their bodies. And it's going to be very hard for them to admit they just made a mistake. Like, I was basically just shooting steroids into my leg. I may now have a beard as a woman. I don't think that that's just going to be something people accept and let slide on. You'll either get very vengeful and aggressive like Chloe Cole, like, I'm going to take this whole system down, or you are going to say, no, I still am who I am, and no amount of oppression is going to hold me down. I think the parents are going to be in an even worse position. So you just saw, what's her name, Miranda from Sex and the City, the actress, give a speech in New York to this crowd of like screaming Brooklyn and Manhattan, again, upper class moms, where she was saying like, my daughter is still the gender that she always was. And I mean, I would assume her daughter is her son. And there have been some pretty serious things that have gone on there. Her son may no longer have a penis. I don't know the details. I don't want to comment too much on the case. But like, if you allowed that for your kid as a parent, like if you took them to another country for a surgical appointment, and then you realize the science underlying this was flawed, like you read the full CAST report, I don't know what you're going to do. It would be very easy for you just to say, oh, those are quack doctors in denial. Out in the provinces, I know what my girl told me. And I think that's the way a lot of them are going
to
go.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Helen Joyce has compared them to the Japanese soldiers still in the forest fighting the Second World War long after it ended. I think that's right. And I guess one of the lessons of the Trump era, although I guess this is the Trump era that we live in, is both how quickly an ideology can take hold in society, but then how quickly it can also be dismantled or shaken off. So the trans ideology is a very good example of that. This is something that took a very forceful hold in certain sections of society to the extent that people were mutilating their kids, putting their kids on drugs that they didn't need, sending them off for mastectomies they didn't need, and so on. And it was had a real stranglehold on kind of upper class sections of society in particular. And now it seems that the kind of spell has been broken to a certain extent, although I think there will be long lasting consequences for the people who submitted themselves to it. But it seems that Trump is breaking that spell, and it seems to be turning it over pretty quickly. There's one other issue that seems to be happening with, and I really wanted to get your views on this, because you did some excellent work over the past few years. I guess it's 5 years ago now that we had the COVID hysteria and the lockdowns and so on. It will be 5 years soon. And that seems to be going through a turnaround as well, because Trump has pretty self-consciously installed lockdown skeptics in influential positions. I mean, there's Jay Bhattacharya, who's going to be working in health with Trump. There's RFK, of course, who's a bit more eccentric, shall we say, in some of the ideas that he has. There is this, you know, general sense amongst people who are influencing Trump that lockdown may not have been a good idea, that we shouldn't necessarily respond to pandemics in this way. Do you think that's another spell that is possibly being broken, that, you know, the idea that we should have locked down society, will it soon be established, do you think, that that was probably a bad idea?
I think that's established now. I mean, one of the things I said writing for Spiked, and I mean, some of that, I mean, the data that I generated for you guys, I think was pretty good and made it to some of my books and made it into professional articles. I mean, so there are a couple different levels. One, I think it was absolutely insane to shut down societies, again, like the US or the UK, on the basis of the threat of a 10% increase in the annual death rate concentrated among people who are 81. I mean, that's absolutely insane. And it's insane at two levels. One, the things that had to be done to make that happen. I mean, the U.S. national IQ for a period of 2 years dropped 2 points because we weren't training people in school. So, I mean, on the PISA boards and so on, people were performing that much worse after, you know, taking their fake Zoom classes and so on. The impact on education, the impact on substance abuse, the impact on just plain freedom people were not going to their first prom and falling in love of doing this. From an actuarial standpoint, if you set a value of, say, $10 million on each human life, the negative impact of social shutdown far outweighed that. And I think that's something that any colder, more aggressive, more human traditional society would have been able to say very easily. Like, we pity every lost senior, we'll build a monument to them, but we can't stop living. And I think that that monument and continuing with life approach, when you're dealing with wars or plagues or something like that, is the way to go. That's the first level of analysis. The second level of analysis, though, is just that we didn't save many, if any, people. The thing with respiratory viruses is that they find, for example, population reservoirs, like deer in Kentucky still have COVID. They continue to come back in cycles. And until Omicron, I mean, the waves of COVID were each almost as dangerous as the initial wave. I mean, so the plan was that by locking down, we would save people from getting the disease. But the lockdowns in a number of countries continued through most of a year and then into a second year. It wasn't until February of 21, as I recall, that a vaccine really became available. Then a lot of people opted not to take it. So by that point, the majority of people had already had COVID. So you just saw the same number of deaths staggered out over a longer period of time. And with these unexpected spikes, because, for example, you were shutting seniors in the house with people who had essential jobs and were leaving and then coming back and infecting them. So the countries that did the best, I believe Sweden, Belarus, Japan to some extent, although that's an island, they didn't really do anything. I mean, Sweden will explain that they took very complex measures where they encouraged young males to, quote unquote, tithe by going out and helping others. Like, that is wonderful. But what they essentially did was just keep everything below the size of a football stadium open and expect people to behave in a normal, rational fashion. And whether you're talking about native Swedes, recent immigrants, everybody did. So, I mean, Sweden in the end had a lower rate of death than the United States, I think a lower rate of death than Britain. And it's very comparable to the other Nordics, where people also behaved in kind of a civilized, normal fashion, but it's locked down a little more. So I think you gave up an incredible amount in an insane way. And you also did very little in terms of saving lives. We can look across lockdown and non-lockdown countries. And this was actually my piece for Spiked. I mean, about 6 months into the period of shutdown, which went on for quite a while. People pretend this wasn't the case, but 60-70% of businesses were shuttered in suburban Louisville. People were walking around with masks on 9 or 10 months into COVID. And that was pretty typical in a regional, but not even mega city. That was the case around the world from the reports I was getting. But about 6 months in, I looked at lockdown versus non-lockdown regions. I mean, you had entire states. Florida reopened quickly. A number of states never locked down out west. And there were no differences, essentially, in rate of death, once you adjusted for population density and the like. And that made me very skeptical. And it looks like the data that's come in from Bhattacharya, Ioannidis, and so on since then has confirmed that. You want to be very careful with this kind of thing, which is why I waited months, and a lot of people didn't want to talk about this at all until all data was in years later. But there's just an obvious reality to some extent that you're going to have a very, very high cost here from doing something so insane, and then you're going to have to figure out whether there was any benefit. And I think we now see what the answer there was.
Yeah, it's great to see people like you being your skepticism being vindicated on this question and other questions too, and that skepticism now finding voice in Washington itself, in the various ways in which Trump is issuing his executive orders on these questions. My last question for you is, I guess, about what happens next, because it feels very much like it's Trump's America now. In fact, it feels like it's Trump world, you know, that because what he's doing is having global repercussions. And I do think that governments in Europe are going to have to change some of their policies and some of the way in which they're clinging to these old eccentric ideologies. I think that will become increasingly untenable once the culture shifts in Washington, D.C. It feels like it's Trump's world, but at some point the Democrats are going to have to come back. At some point they're going to have to decide who they are, who their leader will be, what they're all about. How do you see that playing out? Are they just a busted flush for the time being? And when they do come back, do you think, will they double down on all the crap that they've been doing over the past few years? Or will they finally think, we need to reconnect with the working classes who have been voted for us for decades and then stopped? Will they have a realization that they need to connect with these people? Or is that just beyond their comprehension now?
It's an interesting question. I mean, they could go either way. If the Democrats, there's a friend of mine online whose Twitter handle is like the feminist TM, making fun of people's like social identifications, basically says over and over that the first party not to be crazy can win for 20 years. And I think Trump now, Trump post this election is almost there. Like, he's not doing the shouting and stamping and so on that he did before. But the point's an obvious one. Like, if Trump does get a little over the line and people get tired of hearing kids online say retard, you know, the Democrats could come back in with sort of standard Bill Clinton messaging. Like, we're not going to tolerate mass immigration. We're not going to tolerate crime. But we also, the Democrats have some real edges in the USA. We also favor healthcare. We're not going to impact Medicare and Medicaid, this kind of thing. And I think those Democrats would win. They would tie the Republicans in the House and the Senate, and then you just have the business party versus the workers party, which is fine. The other thing the Democrats could do would mean defeat through the J.D. Vance presidency. And that is what, from my read online, if you leave Twitter and go to Blue Sky, which is worse, they seem to be prepping to do. Some of this, I'm pretty sure, is actually being organized by outside agents from the right, like the younger Chris Rufo types. But I mean, like, people keep saying things like, we need fat, sassy black women who are full of confidence. And I'm like, I'm looking at this and it's just like, I don't know, Chris, is that you? But like, there are people that are saying it sincerely. And more to the point, you're seeing hundreds of likes under these comments. You're seeing people say like, yes, we need to double down. The problem with our agenda is not that it was too woke. It was that we didn't communicate it well enough. This was a very viral tweet on Twitter just today. Some young guy, Zacho Milchich, or one of those Pod Save America type guys, said, you know, we have all the right ideas already, affirmative action. He listed some of them. We just aren't communicating them. And I think that this is a common Will Stancil. This is a common Democratic idea. Like, people really love illegal immigration. We're just not expressing it as those people need to find a better life or whatever. And that's wrong. People hate a lot of these ideas. People just want to be able to go to work without tripping over bums, needles, prostitutes, hobos from other countries. Like, the actual problem is very simple, but the left refuses to believe it. And I think that there's a 40%+ chance as a betting man that they'll double down on this again, and they will run like the best black woman with the best gay white man, and they'll get slaughtered. So we'll see, but there's a fair chance of that.
Will, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe, and in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.